Hi, you're listening to Humanities Viewpoints, a podcast from the Humanities Institute at Wake Forest University. I'm your host, HI Program Coordinator Amy Meppam. This month's guest is Dr. Sarah Hogan. She'll be talking about utopian literature, specifically Thomas More's Utopia from 1516. We'll discuss the etymology of the word utopia, the history of More's book and its relevance today, as well as the current pervasiveness of dystopias, utopian literature's sister genre. Sarah Hogan is an assistant professor in the Department of English at Wake Forest University. Her teaching and research interests are in early modern British literature, utopian studies, and cultural theory. She is currently at work on a book, Island Worlds and Other Englands, Utopia, Capital, and Empire, 1516 to 1660. Her writing has appeared in the Journal of Early Modern Cultural Studies, the Journal of Medieval and Early Modern Studies, and Upstart, a Journal of English Renaissance Studies. To hear more on the subject of utopias, don't miss Utopia, Dreaming the Social, a one-day interdisciplinary symposium. It takes place from 10 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. on Wednesday, March 2nd, at the Rinalda House Museum of American Art. The event is sponsored by the Program in Medieval and Early Modern Studies, with additional sponsorship from the WFU Humanities Institute, made possible in part by a major grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities, the WFU Department of History, and the WFU Department of Philosophy. Featured speakers include several WFU faculty members, including Dr. Hogan, as well as faculty guests from Indiana University and Loyola University Chicago. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Thanks for joining me today, Sarah.
Thank you for having me.
So I wanted to get started. If you could tell us a little bit about how Thomas More came to write Utopia 500 years ago, hopefully telling us a little bit about the work's backstory and structure, also including what we might know about More's intentions in his writing it in the first place.
Sure. So in 1515, the year before Utopia was published, Thomas More was a relatively young man, but he was already quite impressive. He was a successful London lawyer, an under-sheriff, a member of Parliament, a member of the Mercer's Company, and he was already becoming a kind of international figure who represented probably England's most notable humanist. He was known then for his knowledge of classical texts and languages, for his command of rhetoric and grammar, and he was a prominent advocate for the New Learning, right, which was the kind of humanist school of thought, which basically sought to bring the spheres of classical erudition and civic action together. Mm-hmm. But in 1515, the year when he started to write Utopia, he had taken on a new role. Basically, he was sent on an embassy to Bruges at the request of King Henry VIII and on behalf of London's wool merchants. And there he was responsible for negotiating a trade contract with the Holy Roman Empire. And so while he was, you know, in this sort of space with a little more free time than usual while abroad, negotiations had stalled. They did not actually go very well. He took some time to pen a playful fiction about an unknown but ideal society that was located someplace in the Atlantic Ocean near the equator. And this would later come to be called Utopia, of course. It's worth remembering that this was an era of increased exploration when there were lots of stories of new lands and new people saturating the literary atmosphere. So people were becoming relatively accustomed to hearing about these strange ways of living abroad. More's narrative is a kind of parody of this sort of travel writing, but it's also drawing upon a tradition of philosophy, the classical ideal society. And, you know, basically what emerges is this rich description of a whole way of living, a whole society. Some people call it a kind of speaking picture. It's a description of a society where there are various things like a six-hour workday, property held in common, everybody is employed, so you have full employment. You have elected officials, quite revolutionary for More's time.
Right.
You have universal housing and healthcare. Everybody eats. And then there's just time in the day for people to learn, to worship, and to seek out other forms of pleasure, like reading or music or something along those lines.
Sounds good.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it? So Utopia sort of starts as a kind of verbal sketch of this imaginary island, and it looks a lot like England, actually. There are 54 city-states, in Utopia. In England, there were 53 counties plus London. So there's a kind of encouraged parallel between the two worlds in the sort of initial draft of Utopia that Moore was writing while he was in Antwerp and Bruges. Of course, it was also written in Latin, so it was meant to kind of amuse fellow humanists who would know, of course, that this was not really a real society. But if you, you know, go into like a bookstore today and you pick up a copy of Utopia, what you immediately see is that it's actually two books. Mm-hmm. And sometimes when people teach Utopia, they only teach the second book, but the first book, I believe, is just as important mm-hmm. as the second, and it has a very distinct character and form. And Moore wrote this second book, which became the first book, actually it was a new frame, when he returned to England in 1516. And in the summer of 1516, he was himself debating whether or not to join the royal service mm-hmm. of King Henry VIII. So he wrote this new frame, which is actually sort of a statesman's analysis of the problems in England. So the new frame, the new book one, is about England, right. Whereas the second book becomes about Utopia. Mm-hmm. And this new book did some other things too, like it's restructured the whole work as a debate and as a consideration of this question, you know, should a philosopher serve a king? And that's a question that kind of dates back to classical works like Plato's Republic, for instance. Right. So basically, in this debate, there are two prominent interlocutors, though there's also a third. One of the voices is the traveler Raphael Hippodaeus, right, who's the speaker who has traveled to Utopia, mm-hmm. or ostensibly done so. And then there's another character named Thomas Morris. Yeah. and obviously, this is a kind of fictional persona mm-hmm. of the author's own self. And in the new book one, what will happen is that they're going to kind of have this argument about whether or not scholars like themselves should be part of a court. And the character of Morris will insist on service, and one has to sail the ship of state, he says. And Hippolyte will suggest that, you know, anybody who means to kind of speak truth to power will never be heard in a European monarchical court. And sort of to prove his point, he sort of starts sharing all of his very radical ideas, which might shock many readers. And he starts talking about things like vagrancy in England. He's railing against capital punishment mm-hmm. and the treatment of criminals. Mm-hmm. He's talking about the injustice of agrarian enclosures of peasant land. Mm-hmm. He's talking about the causes of employment. He's mocking court flattery and willful kings. Henry VIII is nowhere named, but everywhere implied.
Right.
he's advocating for commonwealths that are quite peaceful, mm-hmm. right, that don't engage in expansionist wars and things of that sort. All of the sort of problems in England, though, Hippolyte traces back to private property, and he and Moore split on this position. Moore still thinks Hippolyte should serve some king, but he actually disagrees with him on this matter of private property. And so, to sort of set up book two, what Raphael says at that point is, well, you know, you don't believe that a society of common property is possible? Well, let me tell you about one, mm-hmm. right?
Right?
So now, you know, the new second book, the description right. of the Utopian island, is clearly more than an amusing fiction,
mm-hmm. yeah.
if you will.
Yeah.
It's a kind of thought experiment that is clearly about sort of encouraging contemplation of alternative ways of living differently. And it's going to ask readers to debate themselves, right, whether or not radical systemic change is possible.
So utopia is a word that is used, you know, frequently in casual conversation, but often misused. So could you talk a little bit about the etymology of the word, specifically the difference between utopia with a UT and utopia with an EUT, and why that difference is important?
Sure. You know, actually, I'll just say that a lot of scholars think that the word utopia mm-hmm. was actually invented not by Moore, uh-huh. but by Moore's dear friend Erasmus, the Dutch humanist. Mm-hmm. And Erasmus was responsible for the first printing of the book in 1516. Okay. Moore had originally tried to name his island Nesquama, uh-huh. Which was Latin for a place of nothing mm-hmm. or non-existent. But Erasmus seems to have encouraged him to stick with this sort of pattern of naming everything with a playful Greek neologism that mm-hmm. had a very ironic meaning.
Right.
So just to, you know, kind of set up the conversation about the meaning of utopia, I think it helps to know, for instance, that Hippolyteus, the name given to the speaker, the traveler,
right. mm-hmm.
who reports on Utopia, his name actually means speaker of nonsense.
Okay.
Morris, right, clearly, obviously suggests you know, the surname of Moore.
Right.
But it also, in Greek, had the meaning of folly. I mean, just think about the contemporary word moron.
Right, right. Right.
Or if you sort of read about Utopia, you see that there's a central river running through the main city, mm-hmm. and that river's name is Ander, which means waterless.
Right.
So there's this whole sort of playful, mm-hmm. ironic use of language throughout the book, which has sparked a lot of debate over the centuries. But as you mentioned, Utopia is, you know, a Greek invention of Moore's book,
right?
Whether it was Erasmus or Moore, it was up in the air. And Topia in Greek means place, quite obviously. Mm-hmm. But the U at the start of the word could refer to either the prefix OU, which would mean no, or EU, which would mean good. So the original use of the word is quite brilliant and ambiguous, mm-hmm. and provocative, and it definitely has some kind of double meaning that is both referring to a no place and a good place. Good place is pretty straightforward. No place, I think, is more of a open sort of suggestion. Mm-hmm. Some people have taken that to mean implausible,
right?
A world that could never exist.
Sure.
And other people sort of see no place as merely a kind of ironic wink. Remember, mm-hmm. this is a fiction.
Right.
It's structured to look like a travel narrative, but of course, Utopia is not a real island. One of the interesting things I find is that when you tell students about this, mm-hmm. often they seem to want to settle the meaning,
right? Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. And say, you know, Moore meant for Utopia to be a good place with better policies, meant for mm-hmm. implementation in England. And then there are other people who say, no, Moore is just mocking the possibility for any kind of, right. you know, alternative order. He thinks that this is, you know, an absurd society that mm-hmm. he's describing. But to me, the key point is that the word is already a kind of encapsulated debate. And then if we think about that word as kind of at its etymological roots, having a debate sort of signaled within it, it might make us think about utopias as mechanisms designed to provoke discussion, mm-hmm. right? That will force people to entertain ideas for social improvement that might at first seem very implausible. So, you know, I think you're right, though, too, that, and I'm happy you're asking the question about, you know, how we sort of understand utopia today, mm-hmm. Because it's radically different from this definition that I've just given you, which is rooted in the original use. Mm-hmm. And I think the word still has a lot of purchase mm-hmm. in the presence. I think we use it often for very political and rhetorical means.
Right.
And I think, you know, if you open up most dictionaries today, they define utopia as a perfect society.
Right.
You know, a society without flaw.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, we're all, you know, far too skeptical for
right.
that notion,
yeah.
of course. Right? We know that there is no perfect world. We know that there is no all-providing nature. We
mm-hmm.
know that we human beings are flawed. So, you know, I think to define it as perfect immediately is to kind of dismiss utopianism, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or perhaps to use it even in a way that is slanderous,
right?
For something to be utopian is to be naively
right.
optimistic.
Mm-hmm.
Someone has their head in the clouds
right, yeah.
And is disengaged from reality. Or, you know, even worse, sometimes we mean utopia, you know, as a kind of will to domination,
mm-hmm.
totalitarianism,
yeah.
and this
right.
is somewhat of the legacy of the Cold War reaction mm-hmm. to communism,
right.
which has had a long kind of complicated history with utopianism too.
Mm-hmm.
But if we go back to the origins of the word, if we look closely too at the literary tradition, I think we see that utopias are much more self-aware. They're actually very skeptical,
right.
because they are critiques of the present.
Mm-hmm.
They're very playful and ironic and ambiguous. And they certainly never, ever promise absolute
right.
perfection. And in fact,
right.
I mean, if you read Moore's Utopia, you see that the utopian island is a pre-Christian state. And we know that Moore was a Catholic martyr. There is no way that
mm-hmm.
his, you know, perfect world probably would have not had knowledge of Christ.
Right, right. Okay, could you talk a little bit more about the classical influences on Moore's text?
Sure, of course. Yeah, Moore's book has a lot of predecessors, like all texts,
sure,
really.
Right.
Right? Nothing emerges in a vacuum.
Yep.
There are some very sort of prominent influences, sometimes even encoded in the book
mm-hmm.
Themselves, named explicitly by Moore. Some of the early influences are Lucian's second century Greek satire, The True Histories. I think Moore was a translator of Lucian, and he seems to be getting a lot of his humor and his parodic relationship to travel writing from him. Certainly, Augustine's City of God mm-hmm. is a prominent influence. Moore was reading that work and teaching it, actually,
okay.
In the lead-up to writing Utopia. But The influence that most listeners might be very familiar with is Plato's Republic, also Aristotle's Politics too, but we hear that Raphael Hefodeh, the traveler who reports on Utopia, is a great admirer of Plato's. And, you know, there are a lot of similarities between the polis described in the Republic and the Utopian Island. And, of course, Utopia is also a dialogue, like the Socratic dialogue of the Republic. So some of these, you know, crossovers include the communal property of the polis and the island. There are some funnier similarities, like strange premarital rituals of viewing one another naked. Morris having a little fun. and just in general, the whole kind of concern with the question about the relationship between philosophers and kings is a central point in the Republic, too. Though I would sort of stress that there are some very real differences between Moore's book and the classical tradition of ideal societies, and the comparison to the Republic helps. For one, I would just say that Moore's Utopia is far more egalitarian and less autocratic than Plato's Republic. Also, you know, if you read Plato's Republic, it suggests that the polis is sort of a pattern drawn from heaven. It's a kind of allegory that's meant to serve as a model, a philosophical model for the tripartite soul, how one should sort of govern themselves and seek truth as a subject, right, and how one can live virtuously. But Moore is sort of taking this philosophical tradition, and he's sort of seeing it as a statesman would, to some degree, too. And he's really thinking more about how it is that institutions, law, and government can reform individuals. So he's kind of taking a philosophical tradition and seeing it in a more explicitly political way. I actually think, you know, that maybe one of the main concerns of Moore's book is how to grapple with this problem of scarcity. That's a very rational concern. Right. It's a very worldly concern. What he's doing is sort of saying, you know, in a world without perfect nature, how is it that we best meet people's needs and insatiable desires? How do we allocate resources so that we can create conditions where people can live more morally? And this is his very kind of worldly, rational concern. And even, you know, there are ways in which I think the book is looking ahead to Enlightenment discourses, like political economy almost, as much as sort of looking back at philosophical tradition. And, you know, all of this, of course, is also filtered through travel writing, which is anthropological and geographical in that time. And it's worth saying that, you know, Moore's ideas are not merely philosophical. He's taking some ideas from Vespucci's writings, from Peter Martyr's chronicles about voyages to the New World, where there were reports of natives living communally with no difference between mine and thine. And Moore is clearly kind of working with these ideas too. So there's that kind of cultural relativism encouraged by those works, sometimes also foreclosed by those works too. But in general, this is just to say that there is a way that the philosophy is combining with a kind of realism, right? And this accounts for how Moore is sort of blurring truth and fiction throughout his book.
So I'm thinking about other, for lack of a better word, kinds of utopias, right? So like a work like Charlotte Perkins Gilman's Herland could be described as a feminist utopia. What other kinds are there? How does this idea play out in other works of literature?
Yeah, that's a great question. Basically, you can name a political orientation and we could pair it with a utopian fiction. and I'm really happy you asked this question because, you know, utopias are often equated with socialism or small-c communism. And there is indeed a long history of kind of canonical socialist utopian novels, in particular, like in the 19th century, there are, you know, quite a batch, including William Morris's News from Nowhere, Edward Bellamy's Looking Backward, both of which were very widely read. But, you know, maybe, you know, to start to answer this question and to think about other kinds of utopias, it might be worth sort of saying something about how utopia has always been something larger than a literary genre. And of course, I'm approaching it usually as a sort of English professor, so I'm talking about it as a genre. but we could also discuss utopia as a kind of social movement, a political platform, some kind of communal experiment. So utopia is way more than a literary form. And, you know, I think it's really important to discuss other kinds of utopias too. For instance, like, you know, a great well-known example would be Martin Luther King Jr.'s I Have a Dream speech, probably the most, you know, important utopian moment or expression of the civil rights movement. We can also talk about a lot of other non-literary books that could be considered utopias, like Shulamith Firestone's A Dialectic of Sex. We could talk about a movement like the Occupy movement as utopian. If you saw, you know, television footage of Occupy, or if you were involved with it, one of the most prominent signs there was "Another world is possible."
Right.
This is a famous slogan to the anti-globalization movement. So, utopia, I think it's important to have a very inclusive definition of what we mean by it. And I'm particularly invested in talking about it as a literary tradition, but that's more because of my own disciplinary background.
Sure.
But to get back to the question about, you know, diverse political orientations to utopian literature, there are a lot of separatist female utopias.
Right.
In general, I would just say the 1970s are a watershed moment for utopian literature. And I mean, of course, that has a lot to do with the fact that it's, you know, a watershed moment for political transformation.
Sure,
And, you know, another separatist female utopia would be Joanna Russ's new wave science fiction novel, The Female Man, which was written in the early 1970s. You could also say, though, too, that, you know, Gilman's book has its own predecessor. We could talk about a work like Christine de Pizan's The Book of the City of Ladies, which is an early 15th century French sort of utopia, which is a defense of women's virtue and makes radical arguments about the need to educate women. Or you could talk about Margaret Cavendish's 17th century Blazing World, which is about, it's a fantastical work where she's sort of imagining herself as the ruler over a community of animal scientists. So there's a long, rich tradition of feminist utopias. One could teach a whole class. And, you know, far more than feminist utopias, there are lots of other types of utopias. I'm thinking of anarchist utopias. Probably my all-time favorite utopian novel is Ursula Le Guin's The Dispossessed. Mm-hmm. That is in this tradition. I would highly recommend it. There are Afrofuturist utopias by really important American novelists like Samuel Delaney and Octavia Butler. There are queer utopias, and here I'm again thinking of Delaney and his work, particularly Trouble on Triton. There are ecological utopias, Ernest Kallenbach's Ecotopia being, you know, a prominent example, also again from the 70s. And there are maybe even conservative utopias, though most conservative utopias tend to look like dystopias because of some kind of distrust in a state. So these tend to kind of work both within and against the tradition. And I'm thinking here of Ayn Rand, right?
Right.
So, you know, this is just to say that the form is, as you suggested, way more diverse than most people give it credit for being. And I do think that the 20th century was an important sort of intervention into the utopian tradition. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of writers who began to make the interrogation of racism, sexism, a central concern in their utopias, right? So they're no longer just articulating sort of alternatives to a system of class inequality,
right?
But they're coming at other questions of injustice and inequality.
So, yeah, you mentioned two authors I particularly like, Butler and Le Guin, and they're known for writing, you know, science fiction. So what's the relationship between speculative fiction, science fiction, and this idea of utopia? They seem to be, you know, is this an inevitable relationship that happens? Or, you know, especially considering how much just the dystopia is sort of in the zeitgeist right now. We're sort of inundated with dystopias in film in particular, and some literature. So what do you think about the relationship here and what this means? Why are we craving these narratives?
Okay, that's a couple questions.
That's a lot of questions, sorry.
I take them one at a time. But, you know, if we just think first in a very simple way about science fiction, we take, you know, the phrase and we break it into two. There is a kind of suggestion of both realism and a certain degree of empiricism or rationality combined with creativity and mm-hmm. fantasy. And, you know, I've been trying to talk about how Moore's book has a similar kind of two-part structure,
sure,
right?
Sure, yeah.
And so I think that there's actually, you know, a very strong overlap between the traditions, and maybe utopias are even better understood as a subset mm-hmm. of science fiction.
Right, yeah.
Though, if we think historically, we could also say that science fiction is kind of an outgrowth of utopian literature. And in fact, actually, if you do kind of a history of early SF, you know, and a lot of people do, they
right.
often talk about Thomas More's Utopia
sure.
as a founding work in the genre, or maybe they go even farther back to Lucian again. A lot of histories of early sci-fi start too with Francis Bacon's New Atlantis, which is another early modern English utopia
right.
authored in the early 17th century, and that's about an island community of scientists who are heading the state, and it would become a kind of model for the English Royal Society. You know, we know, obviously, Francis Bacon is the sort of prominent father of the scientific method, but it's true that he also wrote this little book, which was inspired by Moore's.
Uh-huh.
You know, there's definitely a kind of shared history there,
right.
Which might not suggest that there's an inevitable relationship,
right, yeah.
but there is, you know, there has always been some kind of sort of shared tradition at work in them. And it's just worth saying, you know, I think they serve the same kinds of functions, and, you know, science fiction and utopian literature have a lot of the same appeals. They're all stories of wonder, stories of discovery. They are projects in world building.
Mm-hmm,
they
right.
ask readers to imagine these wholly other worlds. And they're often stories about encountering difference, different people. They're also these sort of vehicles, though, most probably importantly, of estrangement. Stories about someplace else, but they are in some ways tethered to the present,
mm-hmm.
and they offer some kind of commentary
right.
on the world that is. Speculative fiction and dystopias, though, maybe we have to define what those are, too. And there's a lot of overlap between
of course,
them,
yeah.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And they work predominantly through a device of extrapolation. So they take something, some kind of problem or condition that exists now, and they amplify
right.
it, right? They imagine the future consequences
mm-hmm.
of something that's already taking place.
Right.
And I'm thinking right now about Margaret Atwood's When Crazy
uh-huh,
as an example.
Yeah.
If you read that book, right, which is from the early 21st century,
mm-hmm.
You see that, you know, her future society is one of rampant bioengineering, tremendous wealth inequality,
yeah.
and environmental destruction. And this leads to near total genocidal collapse.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's a pretty dark book.
Yeah.
Atwood, when she talks about writing this book, describes how she collects newspaper clippings
mm-hmm.
about scientific and social trends. And these become the kinds of seeds for her fictions projected into the future. So, you know, there's something kind of different at work there. But they're also, you know, utopias and dystopias, I believe, are kind of better understood as sister genres than
mm-hmm.
antithetical ones in
sure.
some way. They're both about interrogation
mm-hmm.
of historical trends, right? And they're both, in some ways, invested in redirecting history toward a better course. And that's a very real similarity, though obviously utopias tend to offer positive alternatives that are meant to kind of provoke hope
right.
or that are meant to kind of educate our desires,
mm-hmm.
if you will. Whereas dystopias look more like works of horror. They tend to frighten us into changing by showing us terrible outcomes
right,
of what
yeah.
is already occurring.
Cautionary
right?
tales and yeah.
Mm-hmm. Precisely. But again, you know, the key point is that both genres are interrelated, I think, because they mean to diagnose contemporary crises. They mean to make those visible
right,
to readers.
Yeah, right.
Though utopias do lay out possible alternatives, and they avoid some of the fatalism
right.
of dystopias too. But our moment of rampant dystopianism and, you know, the pervasiveness of zombie narratives
yeah.
is undeniable. I guess I see this as a kind of symptom of a time of pronounced economic and environmental crisis,
mm-hmm.
and also simultaneously as about a kind of changing American relationship to technology,
mm-hmm. yeah.
where we no longer see it simply as the fix,
right.
but we also think of technology as something we've become overly dependent
mm-hmm.
on.
Right, yeah.
So hence, you know, that we've had a changed relationship, let's say, to car culture.
Right.
I mean, if you look back at something like the New York World's Fair of 64, 65, you see it was pretty the zeitgeist was, I guess, if we go back to that term,
sure, sure.
Right, was one of a sort of profound faith in technological progress, mm-hmm. of a belief in the corporate future.
Right.
I think for many people now, these seem like naive promises, mm-hmm. or mere market strategies,
sure.
of advertising, mm-hmm. that try to kind of rechannel our genuine desires for things like community or purpose or personal happiness into, mm-hmm. consumption. I think a lot of people, certainly myself, believe that it's this kind of naive techno-optimism, mm-hmm. or corporate utopianism, which has to some degree distracted us from creating futures that are genuinely peaceful, mm-hmm. equal, and sustainable. So I think that explains in part some of the sort of shift away from utopianism. But I would say I think we need more utopian literature.
Yeah.
It's probably harder to write because, you know, it's not premised so much on conflict.
Right.
But I think we do need more speculative fiction and science fiction that will educate our desire, because we have to imagine radical, plausible social alternatives if we want to address present crises, mm-hmm. like climate change.
So how do you get students interested in a text like Moore's Utopia?
Well, I think it's actually still a very provocative book. I find that students are really with Raphael Hithloday while, mm. reading the first book. They find his viewpoint to be very modern and,
yeah.
compelling. Mm-hmm. They join in with his critiques of the conspiracy of the rich. But then they get to the second book, and they get to the description of the Utopian Island, and,
yeah.
I think they feel like it falls short of the egalitarian world they hoped to find there.
Yeah.
And so they often react to the book with a lot of resistance, and there's often a lot of heated discussion about the book. I don't,
sure.
have to do much, actually,
sure, yeah.
to get them interested, because it is so provocative.
Yeah.
And they're right to kind of observe that there are all kinds of policies and practices, mm-hmm. in utopia that we moderns would not want to live with. Mm-hmm. They often observe the homogeneity,
right.
of the island,
right.
for instance. Every city looks the same, everyone dresses the same. Mm-hmm. Or they express disappointment about the use of slavery in the island. And I will note here, you know, this is not chattel slavery. This is not the slavery of a race. This is instead slavery used kind of as an antidote to capital punishment. So it's meant to kind of reform people through labor. But they react with horror,
mm-hmm.
to a lot,
yeah.
of this,
mm-hmm.
And rightfully so. So, you know, I think it's really important to discuss utopia's flaws, mm-hmm. and I think that that discussion often helps us, mm-hmm. begin discussing as a class what we think are alternative ways of actually realizing something like equality,
right.
or justice. And so that's a very worthwhile conversation. At the same time, you know, as somebody who teaches 16th and 17th century British literature, you know, I also remind them that that could be considered an anachronistic way of reading,
mm-hmm.
and that Moore structured the book the book itself to create a kind of comparison between utopia and Tudor England.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so I ask them to instead kind of read the book, you know, as if they were someone living in Moore's own time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when they do so, they start to sort of be a little more generous with utopia, with the book, and I think with the kind of mechanism of thought too, and see that maybe there's more possibility there, that it is an important kind of indictment on the present. And I also think it's worth saying that a lot of them are quite, you know, excited by book two too.
Right.
Because there are policies there that are appealing even from a modern day,
mm-hmm. right.
vantage point. No one starves. No,
yeah.
one goes hungry, no one is homeless, there are no people looking for work that can't find it. There's also this interesting thing that happens where a lot of students say, you know what, our world looks more like Tudor England,
right.
than utopia.
Yeah.
And sometimes then they even bring that also back to a perspective which says, well, Thomas More was writing this book during the transition from feudalism to capitalism.
Right.
This,
yeah.
book is about, in some ways, the systemic changes,
right.
wrought by that economic transformation. We still live under capitalism. So rather than seeing these as sort of trans-historical or universal problems, they begin to think systemically about, you know, whether or not capitalism can solve those same ongoing issues, mm-hmm. right, which are very prevalent today. And, you know, it's interesting. I've been following the Democratic primaries quite closely. And whenever I talk about old literature, I try to make it relevant to students. Mm-hmm. This book, I mean, it's, the parallels are absolutely uncanny. When you're thinking about, like, the difference between the candidates Clinton and Sanders, it's almost like their platforms and their perspectives divide along the same lines mm-hmm. as the characters of Thomas Morris and Raphael Nicodaeus, which is all just to say that, you know, I love to teach utopian literature, mm-hmm. and I think that, you know, even an old work of utopian right. literature, like Moore's, can help sort of modern readers imagine what progress looks like and what real equality looks like. And I think that the book encourages everybody to be more open-minded in the discussion of radical systemic reform.
Thanks again for being here today, Sarah.
Thanks for having me.
That was Sarah Hogan on Thomas More and the Continuing Relevance of Utopian Literature. Don't forget to attend Utopia Dreaming the Social from 10 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. on March 2nd at the Rinalda House Museum of American Art. You can find this and other episodes of Humanities Viewpoints at humanitiesinstitute.wfu.edu/podcast. You can also find us on iTunes. Just search for Humanities Viewpoints in the podcast section. Thanks for listening.